Welcome to the Ralph Moore Podcast. Gain the leadership advantage as Ralph pulls wisdom from his bag of over 50 years' experience in planting and leading multiplying churches. Our goal is to help you live as a leader you'd want to follow. You'll learn about making disciples and planting churches, but beyond that, you'll gain practical wisdom about subjects like how to manage your team, handling difficult people, pulling a congregation off a growth plateau, and even money management.
Hi, welcome to the podcast. Today is a really, really top dollar day for me. I am interviewing one of the nicest people I know in the whole wide world. You may think of him as some kind of a famous author, and you've probably read three or four at least of the books that he's written. I just think of him as one of the nicest people I know, actually to the point we were just talking about this, that I sometimes feel uncomfortable because he's so nice and I'm so not. But anyway, I want you to my friend here is Alan Hirsch. And Alan, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here with you, Ralph, as always. Yeah, awesome.
Well, as we get started, one of the things I like to do is always ask people, before we get into the nuts and bolts of whatever we're talking about, just tell me a little bit about your journey to faith. I've heard it, but I'm pretty sure there's some other people who would like to hear a little bit about what went on in South Africa when you were a kid, and then, you know, where it all went on from there.
Well, yeah, one of the aspects you've already mentioned there, bro, is that, yeah, I was born in 1959 in South Africa, which means smack bang in the middle of apartheid South Africa. Apartheid South Africa is, you know, a thing of the past now, but I mean, the reality is still present. But it really was a profoundly racist kind of world where, you know, basically the whites ruled over the majority of the black people in Africa, and in with great cruelty and, and a lot of complicity of the church. So growing up in that, as another thing about me, from a Jewish background, I'm a Jewish kid, and Jews were considered white, but we were Jews. And the government, what's called the nationalist government, is a good clue to what it was on about, was, well, you wouldn't call them neo-Nazi, but they were very close to that. It's certainly heading in that direction. They were very attracted to National Socialism in Germany during the war, very anti-British, and they had become the government in what was then to be called the Republic of South Africa. So that was a very, so growing up in as a Jew and end up going to an Afrikaner school. Afrikaners were the Dutch derivative peoples, white people who basically were the majority of whites too. You know, we're Dutchies, so they're big, and I'm not so much. You know, I'm a 5'7" guy, but but going through school, I was the effing Jew, and it was like I had to fight a lot. I mean, I ask a lot of people, how many fights did you have? Well, they said two or three, maybe throughout your life, you know, through your school life, and I never counted, but probably between 30 and 50. I don't know, never counted, but a lot of them, and. I was quite good, Ralph. So, you know, I think I only drew one of them. I was pretty good because I'd learned to be a little ninja. And but it's, you know, somewhat traumatic, actually, growing up in that and in that kind of environment. And then also at odds with apartheid, never made sense to me. I was also drafted into the army, as most white kids had to do. So I did 2 years of military, inverted commas, service. The alternative was jail, military jail, which I didn't really want to do. So off I went. I went to the medical corps, which was part of the infantry, but you know, again, a lot of violence, a lot of, you know, very disturbing kind of things. And the army, being what it is a pretty tough kind of environment too. So in order to cope with that, I did copious amounts of marijuana. Now this plays in my world, right? So, in order to chill out from all that stuff, marijuana. But the guy who introduced us into this was a guy in our smoker circle, who he was kind of our leader in the group, you know, and we did Stone together, and he was like the poet, philosopher, writer. You know, we loved him. He's a guy called Murray. And he has this encounter with the Holy Spirit one weekend and goes to a Pentecostal service and is touched by the Holy Spirit. And he comes back into our group. He doesn't leave us, you know, doesn't ditch us, stays, but he changes, you know, he stops all the nonsense that we were doing. And he's still a lovely, beautiful human being. And so we, you know, he has a huge impact upon me. And so I'd say like, I would say very important role in my life. Eventually, you know, went over to Australia. But that's my South African side. I don't know if you have any questions about that. But quite a violent context. I think I would call it quite traumatizing. But definitely God was after me, you know. And by the way, I should say this because, I could experience Ralph when I was a kid, when I was about 12 or 13. It must have been the movie Ben-Hur, and I'm not even sure, I can't remember exactly, but I think it was Ben-Hur. And in the original Ben-Hur, you have this furtive background figure who plays a role in the back, you know, and it's Jesus, right? And I remember watching that movie and crying. This Jewish kid, I didn't know who he was or what, but I knew my life was to be defined by that person. And I felt, and I can look back now and have to be clear about that, Jesus has always been after me. I mean, he's always sought me out before I found him, you know, he found me. And I think that's part of that experience through. For me, that took drugs to chill me out, to be able to kind of engage those ideas. But yeah, he did. And even in drugs, we had a lot of spiritual experiences that led me to Jesus.
So when did you actually, you know, fall in? When did you surrender?
Well, in 82, my family, I had to leave South Africa. It was not in the, I was going to leave. And my folks knew that. And they felt that, and they're a Jewish family, so felt that if we didn't go together, the family would split apart. And so my folks put in for immigration to Australia. So in 82, we immigrated to Australia. And I had a girlfriend at the time. She'd come over, not as an immigrant. She was just a visitor's visa. We were living together and in Melbourne, Australia. And then I felt that God say to me, and it was clear to me, right, that you're going to die soon, mate. Get your act together. And I didn't know whether death was spiritual death or physical death, but I knew I had to stop running from him. Mm-hmm. And so I went to try and find someone to lead me to Jesus. I had no idea what I was looking at. And eventually I was working at that time. I was trained in marketing and advertising, but couldn't get a job. It was 82, so there was a big recession at that time. You will remember that.
Yeah.
So the advertising world was not taking anyone. So I ended up working in a Radio Shack. And I'd heard in the one that I was in that there was another one in another suburb that everyone wanted to ditch and leave because the manager there was a Christian and was Bible bashing everyone.
Uh-huh.
I said, send me there. I'll go. Because I needed to go and find someone to bring me to Jesus, right? And so off I went, I transferred over there. And true enough, that weekend he leads me to the Lord in the back of the Radio Shack.
Wow.
The following weekend he took me to meet, this is the defining experience of my life. Takes me to go and meet his pastors. And so we go for dinner at their place, my girlfriend and myself. And they're very different people to me. You'll understand this, right? I'm like druggy, rebellious, you know. With a lot of history there with, you know, South Africa and all that. These people are not my people. I mean, they're just different, right? They're very, you know, Christian. And then they, you know, when they pray, they speak very loudly in tongues and they're like snake hand types, right? So at a certain point, we had dinner with them and then we split. I went to go and pool with the guys, and my girlfriend stayed with the women. And eventually, at one point, they say, bring him down, the Holy Spirit's here. So all the guys grab hold of me and literally drag me to the kitchen where something's happening. And they sit me down, thank God, and they begin to pray over me in very, very loud tongues and crazy, you know, weird, wonderful stuff about casting out and praying for the baptism of the Spirit. And lo and behold, my friend, I met God. I mean, I have no words for what happened to me that I cannot describe it. And I'm reasonably articulate. I cannot describe what happened to me that day. It was utterly life-changing. And I still can't describe it now. I'll just leave it there. It just was, I met God and everything changed, you know, and my life was, yeah, a whole new course of life was set. And, you know, I'm still here today. So, sure. I'm the Lord of the long answer, brother. So you can discipline me at any point.
You know, as I hear you talk, and I've had this kind of thought before, in a way, I envy that. You know, I grew up in church, and I was age five. I accepted Jesus, and I really did. I knew what I was doing. They explained it well enough. I knew what I was doing. And by age six, I had an experience, and I won't get into it because I've talked about it before, but I knew God wanted me to be a pastor, and I just hated it. I was a little kid, and the only reason I knew it was real was I hated it so bad. And, you know, it's like, I'm never going to do that. And it wasn't until I was about 17, probably, that I gave into it. So I was this kind of wishy-washy Christian all the way growing up. And a lot of times I've thought about people who had kind of a dark past, and then boom, they met Jesus, and I wish that would have happened to me in a way. Mm. I'm not fighting against what did happen to me. Mm. You know, I grew up in a wonderful. My dad accepted Christ. That's how I accepted Christ. I went to a Youth for Christ rally with my 30-year-old father. I was five, and so from then on, it was a Christian home, and I thank God for that. But it was all gray. My spiritual life was all gray. It was never from black to white. And I look at what you experienced, and it's like, you know, and sometimes I'm in awe of that. You know, in the hippie days, we had all these people coming, people who are loaded on heroin, and suddenly they're sober. And now they know Jesus. And it's like, whoa. So I think it's a treasure that you have. And, But take us kind of from there. I know how you met your wife, Deborah. Take us to a point where, you started changing the world, because you changed, really. And I know you're going to have to be humble about this, but you really changed the evangelical world, the evangelical worldview, with the first book that you wrote. How did you get from this Pentecostal moment to there, where you begin to write things that were really ripping people apart? You know, I met a guy just this last week who was in Texas, and he went to a seminary, and while he was in seminary, he read one of your books, and he said, I had to drive 2 hours to find somebody who was starting in Texas, right, the Bible Belt, the whole deal. And he goes, I had to go 2 hours before I could find a church that was meeting in a movie theater that was getting started, because nobody in Texas, they're all about big and fancy and all that. And he goes, Alan Hirsch wrecked me, but he drove me. And this guy is having, it's wonderful what he's doing. But how did you get from that, what I'm going to call a Pentecostal moment, where you really encounter Jesus, to the point where you begin to rattle all of our cages? Take us there.
Wow, bro. Again, thank you for your generous take on me. I don't feel that I'm any more significant than
you. I know you don't, you shook us up.
Well, I mean, The Shaping Things to Come is the book you're referring to, the first book I wrote. And for me, that book was very much part of a journey that we were on. I went to theological college, ended up working in an inner city church. There's even a backstory to that, which is kind of intriguing. You know, my wife had come to the Lord. You'd appreciate this, bro, because, you know, this is your world and the Jesus movement. But she came to the Lord on acid, watching the late great Planet Earth. with her sister, with the two drug dealers who'd become a believer, and they'd broken into their flat one night and they waited for them to come home, and they were just completely whacked, and they showed them the sacred planet Earth, and they converted. I mean, along with many others, and that group really came with Deb and myself to this church in South Melbourne, in the city of Melbourne. And so we like the rent a crowd, you know, like this crazy group of ex-druggies and gay people. It's just a crazy group of people, right? But being in that context and having to do that ministry and had a lot of ministry to the fringes and the edges of society, forced us to, you know, nothing in my theological training prepared me for it, because we've now felt like we were missionaries in the inner city of Melbourne. Large, and you think about inner city, all the classics of there's poverty there, but there's also wealth, a lot of wealth. And then, but all the subcultures are there, including the gay people, which a lot of our folks had come from, a lot of druggies, which I had come from. And so we began to reach out to them. So our church became a church on the edges, you know, we were ministering to the fringes of society. But to do this, we just had to start thinking like missionaries, because nothing in my seminary training prepared me for this. They didn't even teach me how to do a sermon properly, so I was not well prepared. That's a whole story in itself, but it forced me to think like a missionary. And we ended up doing, you know, a local kind of thing called Urban Encounter, which is a training agency to try and train people in urban missions. And we were using kind of missionary methodology in the inner city. You know, we had to contextualize different churches to different settings. So we just learned this kind of intuitively, actually, or, you know, say under the guidance of the Spirit, but that's what we did. And then I was at one point called to lead our denomination, particularly the Department of Mission Education and Development, which was the major part of it. And I think this is paying for my sins.
Ah.
But it forced me to also think about the church in the West as a whole. You know, so in the sitting, I'm thinking like a missionary, like in Papua New Guinea, having to kind of translate the gospel into different subcultures. And then on the macro scale, we're thinking, oh my gosh, the Christendom understanding of the church has delivered us to a particularly crisis moment. It is what got us to this point ain't going to get us further. So I began to map out a way, you know, in my mind, trying to figure out a way forward. I think shaping came from that, bro. And also, by the way, I said shaping was, we'd started a thing, Michael Frost and myself, had started an organization called Forge Mission Training Network, which is still operating all around the world now. Mm. But Forge was our attempt to kind of do church planting in the missionary mode. And really shaping was the curriculum we developed for it. We managed to get a contract in America, which is weird. For two Aussies. And then, so we did a bit more research overseas, packed it up with stories from all over the world. And lo and behold, shaping dropped. And it, it certainly impacted the conversation without a question. Just came at the right time in some ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. And go on.
Well, I was just going to say, in my experience, you know, I came up in a Pentecostal denomination. And I came in a church that was more Baptist than it was Pentecostal, but we were part of the denomination. And then I'd go to youth camps and I'd see things that seemed a little strange to me. And yet I'd see things that also were more real than what I was experiencing in my own church. And it was really kind of a from one year to the next, actually, it's kind of a strange thing, but from 12 months apart in one youth camp, one probably August, I actually go, okay, God, if you want me to do this pastor thing, I'll do it. And then for a whole year, I made a vow to myself, I'm not going to tell my dad, because my dad, I mean, I had wonderful parents. And if my dad engages it and is for it, then I knew enough to know I'm a stupid kid. I'll probably rebel against it and say no. But if he's against it, then I'll probably rebel and say yes. And so I'm keeping him out of it for a whole year. So for 12 months, I go to this next youth camp. And I mean, and this is the kind of thing where, you know, they're kind of pushing people on the floor and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, there's something real going on. Mm. And so it was there that I made this commitment. And then somewhere along the way, I met a guy. His name is Roy Hicks Jr. And he was 2 years older than me. And I grew up in a big church, actually the biggest church in Oregon. And most of my friends, there were seven of us that hung out all the time. I'm the only one that didn't go to jail. But I was a straight and narrow kid, and they all did whatever they did. So, I never had any of that. But then I end up in this Bible college, and I'm seeing things that just don't make sense. It's like I went to a high school that was kind of all male high school, science and math. But my best friends were black kids and a couple Japanese kids. In fact, a couple of them actually got killed in the Vietnam War. And I go to this Bible college, and it's like, they're teaching some good stuff, but the way that they're doing it isn't right. And then I come out, I had read a book about a guy planting churches, multiplying churches in the Philippines. And that kind of really, it's like, I want to do that. I don't know how, I just want to do that. And so then I got out, I was a youth pastor for a number of years. We started a church in Mexico and did a bunch of car washes we paid a pastor, a Mexican pastor, and then we planted a church, and within about a year and a half, we planted a second church, and then pretty much we're starting to do this. But we thought that was like our special calling. We were kind of into ourselves, and it was just nobody else was doing it. So we thought God, stuck us with this thing, and it's good, and it's a special thing. But at that time, it was right around when the whole seeker deal started to emerge in America. And so many, many years later, because that was 1971, it was 2016, I'm thinking about retiring. But so by this time, I'm 79 right now as we speak. So this would have been like 9 years ago. So I was 70 years old. And I meet Todd Wilson, Dave Ferguson, and you. And it's like for the first time in my life, I actually met people who believe what I believe, that we're supposed to make disciples who make disciples. And if we do that well, then churches will come out of that. And even the guys who are planting churches in kind of the established church, their whole deal is, let's go plant a church and maybe we'll make disciples, or we'll have a little class. And then you go through 8 weeks of class and you call that a disciple. And that quite doesn't work out. Mm-hmm. But it's like, I at age 70, I was facing retirement and kind of lonely old man watching TV every day. And now I have a life where I get to interface with some young guys and do whatever I do. But you came out of this thing kind of a lone ranger. That's how I felt, like I was a lone ranger. But you had almost an instant impact. I mean, your books began to really kind of rattle people's cage. And how did positive, negative, what kind of responses did you get to when you first began to write?
It's interesting. Let's come back on that issue of discipleship, somewhere along the way. But I think that's a huge issue. In that I think most Western churches have no clue of what that really means. But let's come back at that. But the impact, understand that we were trying to one guy really, I'm dyslexic, so I can't read like everyone else does. I know everyone thinks I do because I'm kind of a geek. And I read enough, but I read dense thinkers, and then just two pages is enough for me. I can't do much more, but I can get a lot out of it, right? So. So Newbegin was one person who didn't influence me. And what, his challenge was to, theoretically in his world, but in mine, I was trying to actually, what does it mean to be a missionary to the West again? Uh-huh. That the West itself, even though it's had the church in this context for 2000 years, really has inoculated us to real Christianity, and that we need to become missionaries again and adopt, as if we were going to an unreached people groups and trying to find the keys to the culture and the keys to the human heart, present in culture and in human heart. And Renio, that was the basic flip on that. And we were, you know, talking about this practically because we were doing Forge, which is training people to literally plant churches in what we call the incarnational mode. Thinking incarnationally, how would you contextualize both the gospel and the church in a given setting so that it looks different in different settings. And we're dealing with subcultural dynamics. And the church in Australia is very, the evangelical church is very insecure. The leaders are insecure. And so they don't know how to, they see this as a critique against the church. Oh, you know, we hate the church. No, we don't. I love the church enough to say we have to be different and extend it. We have to have different expressions of church.
Yeah.
But, you know, so we were dismissed a lot in our own context, not entirely, but certainly among established churches who had much to defend. Interestingly enough, in America and in Europe, Britain mainly, but Europe, Germany, you know, a few others, it was translated, had a huge impact. I don't know, profit is without honor. I have no idea. But it certainly, I didn't receive any, I wasn't run out of town like I have been here in Australia. Yeah. I was never run out of town in, and partly I would say that's partly because of the second book I wrote, which is called The Forgotten Ways, which was a positive take on how you would become a movement rather than just a critique, which is shaping us a little more critical of our current model and proposing an alternative. Forgotten Ways was much more, a consistent way of actually going about multiplication, church planting, and disciple making. I don't know if that answers the question, bro, but
if you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe and check his blog at ralphmoore.net.